Hi, this is Duff Watkins, host of the YamCham Business Podcast. You're about to listen to another exciting podcast where we talk to CEOs and politicians and people who are of interest in the world. But you know, you can actually download these in your sleep. That's right. You can subscribe to them through iTunes and through a host of applications. So do your brain a favor. Make it easier on yourself. Subscribe to the YamCham Business Podcast. It's at the website yamcham.com.au.
Welcome to the business podcast of the American Chamber of Commerce in Australia. AmCham Business Podcasts are hosted by Dr. Duff Watkins. Duff is a director of Exec Search International, an author, and is also on the AmCham Council of Governors. AmCham, bringing business to you.
Hello and welcome to the business podcast of the American Chamber of Commerce in Australia. AmCham, bringing business to you. Today we ask, how do you design digital products and digital services for humans? After all, we're human beings, not digital beings. So to find out, I went looking for a cultural anthropologist, and you know where I found one? At PwC, PricewaterhouseCoopers. My name is Duff Watkins. I'm the host of the AmCham Business Podcast. Today our guest is Douglas Belton, who goes by DJ. DJ is he works for PricewaterhouseCoopers in the Experience Center. Welcome to the show, Doug. How are you?
I'm doing well, Duff. Thanks for having me.
My first question today is, how does a guy with a business degree from a college in the U.S. who gets a master's in anthropology, he ends up working for PricewaterhouseCoopers, researching digital design for people. How does that all come to be?
I probably took a pretty non-traditional route to the consulting world. You know, coming from the States, I was in the U.S. Army Reserves and was deployed to Afghanistan. In the context of my work there, I worked closely with local villagers to kind of understand what some of their needs and concerns were so that we can direct funding for local infrastructure development projects that would kind of, you know, help out the local community and hopefully mitigate violence. So in the context of that work, I really realized it's a lot of just interesting, engaging with people, getting to know them. Spent some years traveling around the world before that, so I figured, you know, it's probably a good field for me to get into, anthropology, because it's all about, you know, learning culture and learning how people behave in cultural contexts.
You've been doing intercultural work for a while, I see. So that leads me to ask you, well, I guess the culture you're studying now is consumers. Now, the first thing I want to ask you about is, you talk a lot about customer engagement. But when I talk to 50 people, I get 50 different definitions of engagement. So what's your definition of engagement?
So I think engagement is not just about getting people to respond to your strategic communications, your marketing, your advertising in the way you want necessarily. That's kind of, in my view, a bit of an outdated model of engagement. I think today it's about organizations really developing the capability to stimulate, you know, peer-to-peer interest, you know, collect the feedback from their consumers and their customers, analyze it, you know, and then do something meaningful with it. So that's kind of the change, I think, in what engagement means.
Haven't companies been doing that for a long time and through traditional market research?
To varying degrees, yes. I think the difference between market research before and the type of research that we do in design research is that we've kind of moved that process up front. So rather than the best and the brightest of an organization coming together and saying, hey, this is a product or service we want to launch, let's go ahead and test it with the market and see what people think. It's bringing that process to the front and saying, we'll figure out what to design based on human need first. So it kind of flips it on its head in a way. You know, organizations have been doing this in, you know, in different ways for a while now, but I think the difference is just getting more, making it more inclusive from the beginning in terms of engaging with people.
And it's called design research? Is that the name of the field?
Yeah, so it's pretty new. So anytime you have a new thing, there's different people kind of jockeying for you know, naming rights. But a couple of the terms that you'll come across are user experience consulting. And then within user experience consulting, there is the design, which a lot of times works on, you know, building the prototypes, which might be visual or other. And then what you're seeing now is the emergence of research kind of stepping out into its own discrete kind of offering. And this has already happened in the States and in parts of Europe. And it's starting to happen now here in Australia.
What you're talking about, if I understand you correctly, DJ, is it's the human experience that you're researching and you're starting. That's your starting point. And the human experience is not the same as a customer experience.
Well, it can be in some cases. So it can be a customer or it can be your people. If it's working in the capacity of community engagement, it might be community stakeholders. So it really just depends on what it is that you're trying to learn. And that's really what the key difference is, I think, is a lot of the effort in the design world goes into really articulating what's the problem, right? Because an organization might start with an idea that they think is a problem or a challenge that they want to solve for in the market. And by starting this research process early, you might change your thinking. You might get new information that causes you to kind of shift gears a bit and look in a different direction in terms of what problem you want
to
solve.
Okay, well, here's a problem for you to solve. Okay, I'm a consumer. I'm a modern consumer. I go to the supermarket, right? And I have all these brands, all these multinational companies, and they're all vying to occupy my mind share, and they're all seeking, competing for my attention. But here's the trouble. I don't want an experience with that company. I don't want to engage with them. I don't want a relationship. I just want some damn toothpaste. I mean, why does it have to be so hard? And it becomes annoying and downright intrusive, and yet so many of these companies persist in doing it, thinking that they're, I don't know, what, hip, modern, swinging with it?
Yeah.
Contemporary?
Yeah. Yeah, you make a great point. I think a lot of this comes down to, and you'll see this, there's just a proliferation of market choices out there. So one of the challenges businesses have is you know, micro segmenting. It's how do you really, you know, give a segment of your market what they want and the way that they want it. So it's not necessarily a one size fits all. We want to get everybody to, you know, be our best friends and, you know, always buy everything from our brand. A lot of times it's about if that's what they prefer, they want something, you know, very low maintenance, just give me better, cheaper, faster, and leave me alone, then you need to know, you know, how do you offer that, and how do you kind of create a compelling offering for that? And then also, you might have other, with the same product, you might have other segments that do want that kind of high-touch, you know, personalized service delivery. So it's about knowing your market really intimately and then providing products or services to meet their needs.
You talk a lot about getting engagement right. How does a company do that? And let me suggest, one of the things that seems crucial to me is for a company to identify who cares. Who cares about their product or their service, or who cares and who's indifferent?
Yeah, exactly. I think there's a couple of key things that are important for engaging in the 21st century. And one of them is authenticity, right? So people expect to do business with a company that is authentic and genuine. Also, a degree of empathy, I think, is important for an organization, whether they have specialists who really work on understanding their customers and consumers from their perspective, kind of from that inside-out view. That's definitely going to help with engagement. And then also the willingness to experiment with different things, different ways of engaging and seeing what works and putting a little bit of risk on the line so that you can find out what's important to people and move forward accordingly.
Can you give me an example of that, experimenting and taking some risk?
Yeah, so I think one example with experimenting is you might have come across the term agile, and I'll give you, if you haven't, basically agile is just a way of operating where you are being agile to different needs and different changes that happen in the market. So it's going away from this idea we're going to cement in and we're going to lock in a 5-year plan of operating and we're going to power through it, and saying, you know, we need to make that much shorter. It might even be, you know, months on a month scale, and we're going to kind of work, try things out. We're going to test it with the market. We're going to test it with real users, real customers. We're going to refine that. And then after that, once we're really confident that we're hitting the nail on the head, then we'll go ahead and launch it. So that's an example, and that could be, you know, anything from a product. In our case, at PwC, we work a lot, obviously, in digital services. So it might be a client looking to integrate an intranet platform across multiple lines of services, right? So they're really trying to kind of get everybody on the same page, whereas everybody was kind of doing their own thing. You might start with a prototype where you look at what are the functions and features that are going to be important to these different stakeholders in this case, right? So different business people in these different lines of service, and then figure out from there, how do we, you know, what platform, what did it look like? Do a prototype, test it in the market with real users, refine it, and then launch it.
So it's a process of continual adaptation and refinement. And you make a good point, too. I'm talking about engagement as if it were only for customers, but it isn't. It's also used internally within companies. Actually, for the record, I know that you work with a lot of large, major, blue-chip Australian companies, also governments, internally and externally. So this has very, very wide applications.
That's exactly right. And what you're finding now is a lot of our clients are coming to us, and they want to... They want to align their internal strategy with their external strategy. And again, that really touches on the authenticity piece, right? Because if your culture says one thing and then your marketing communication says a complete different thing, or the experience in those two different places are conflicting, they're not aligned, then that's going to send usually a negative message to your customers, right? So it's really important to plan for how to integrate these in internally as well as externally.
Just to remind listeners, you're listening to the AmCham Business Podcast. We're coming to you live and in 2D from the Twitter Australia's offices, and we thank them for their support. Our guest today is DJ Belton of PwC, the Experience Center. DJ, you were saying a customer or the person who's being engaged, what they're looking for? They're looking for empathy. They want to feel understood. Now, I know from my psychotherapy practice in the old days that that's crucially important, to feel understood. They want authenticity. They're seeking that company's not BSing them, that, you know, there is a consistency of what they say and what they do. And the third thing you said was a willingness to share risk, to experiment.
That's right. That's exactly right. Okay. Yeah, and you know, just on that authenticity piece too, I think this is a really crucial one. I mean, we're finding this not just in the business world, but also in government. Part of what contributed to President Trump's success as a candidate was that he was authentic. And the same thing could be said for Bernie Sanders when he was running, you know, in the primary elections, in that, you know, people resonated that message of what you see is what you get. I'm the same today, tomorrow, yesterday. I'm the same behind closed doors as I am, you know, speaking in public. And I think that you're finding that people are willing to make purchase decisions as well as, you know, as is the case today, voting decisions based on how authentic that organization or that person is that they're engaging with.
Okay, tell me more about your line of work. I mean, it's intriguing to me that PwC, big, famous international accounting practice. Well, I mean, they do all sorts of business advisory services, but they're known for the accounting firm, one of the biggest, best in the world. They kind of go out on the limb. So they're walking their talk. They're hiring a guy like you. So maybe tell us a bit more about what you do in your line of work, and tell me why business is booming. And I'm happy to hear that, by the way.
Yeah, excellent. Yeah, so, you know, one of the things is we just had it yesterday over at the International Convention Center. You know, we have Imagine 2020 program, which is really all about, you know, what's the future? How can we, as a firm, be more relevant in society? So it's less this kind of transactional approach. You know, we're going to make as much money as we can, and really that's our primary focus. Well, obviously that's still a focus, but now we're looking at how can we solve big problems that really help our brand in the eyes of the average everyday person. So, you know, that's kind of the context within we work. Now, the line of service I work within in advisory, and then the practice I work within, the Experience Center, we're operating on what's called a BXT model, and BXT stands for business, experience, and technology. So the idea is that, you know, you've got your classic traditional business practices and needs, and you have these technological developments that are happening, and sometimes the technological advancement is outstripping business process advancement, if that makes sense. So the experience, which is what the Experience Center is all about, is really about connecting those two. And this is why, you know, they decided to bring on an anthropologist, and I'm not the only one. There are some others who have that specific training. And it's not necessarily just the anthropology. There's other types of kind of ways of thinking that adopt the same thing that anthropologists are known for, which is that kind of blank slate view of going into a context and learning. That's kind of the context. It's really connecting business and technology through the human experience to better understand what business and technological choices businesses need to make.
So using PwC as an example, so because the technological advances in our society can outrace human development, I guess, because, I mean, it takes a while for our species to evolve, although I'm doing as fast as I can, I suppose. But so what PwC and presumably other firms are, you're trying to enhance that connection between these technological advances and the human beings whom these advances in technology are supposed to serve.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly it. I mean, we you know, so the user experience, you know, design practice, right, which is exactly that. It's looking at how do people interact with technology? How can we anticipate the needs of the future or just on the cusp of the future, right? So how can we anticipate those? So what we do is we'll put products, prototypes. Like I mentioned the example of the intranet service before, it might be website or it might be a new way of working. It might be something that's not even necessarily digital. It could be a strategy or a communication piece. And we put it in front of, you know, the people who are going to be engaging with it, customers, staff, whoever it is. And we test it. We go deep into using qualitative research methods such as contextual interviews, participant observation or behavioral observation, it's also known as well as traditional surveys. And we really try to go deep into that experience. Another method is called usability testing, where it might be kind of in a lab environment. We have a computer set up. We have a customer sit down and actually go through this prototype design of a new digital experience and really try to understand, how is it working? Is it meeting their needs? Would it be something that would be viable and desirable? And then if so, then we know that we're on the money and we develop it. And that's when we put the investment in actually developing the front end, which is the part that people see, and then the back end, which is integrating the digital service in with all of the other kind of internal business processes that need to function to make it work.
So this isn't some sort of shallow suck it and see kind of approach. This is some serious research, which requires investment.
That's exactly right. And this is why the buy-in is so important. As a lot of our clients are really beginning to understand, is that the sooner that you can get this kind of insight, this discovery, is the discovery phase of a research project, which is at the very beginning, where you don't know anything, you're really trying to understand what's it like, you know, through the consumer's eyes or the customer's eyes. And, you know, you make that investment up front so that you don't end up developing and launching the wrong product or service that doesn't make the impact in the market that you wanted to make. So it does take an investment, but usually that investment is going to be made regardless. Either it's going to be potentially money wasted because of not kind of doing your due diligence up front around, you know, what's going to have the impact you want. You know, preferably you'd make that investment up front and you'd have a really clear path forward on what you're doing as an organization.
Kind of reminds me of an old joke. Actually, it's a true story of a pet food company that spent all this millions researching this new super duper cat food and then marketed it and then it came back zero sales, and they did an intensive market analysis and deduced that cats don't like it. You know, just that simple. Yeah. And you think they would. Yeah. So I mean, I've actually been to the Mars factory where they have literally, it's like a little pen of cats, and they use them for testing purposes to see if the cats like the stuff. Good idea, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And think about it. You make that investment up front and it's so small, and then the money that you'd save then in doing the wrong thing, it's incalculable.
We were talking earlier off air about the tribes within consumers or within society, and that's pretty much what an anthropologist does, or a social anthropologist. Can you speak some more about what anthropologists do and don't do?
Yeah, sure. So I'll give you a little kind of historical background, which I was really fascinated by, especially in the context of my experience in the military. Anthropology actually started as a colonial enterprise. And basically, the English powers during the colonial period had sent people out to go learn about the locals, kind of prepare for that colonialist project. So it started out as a very kind of practical, we want to know what are the influencers, what are the motivations of these local people. And then it turned into an academic practice. Wow, we're actually learning some pretty interesting stuff. After a period of time, you started seeing different applications of it. It wasn't just necessarily for a colonial enterprise, which I should make this point, a lot of anthropologists now have spent their entire career trying to rectify the historical practice of what anthropology has been, and they're doing great work in that space. So now you're just as likely to see an anthropologist working for an indigenous tribe, for example, as, you know, anything else. You know, so that's a little bit of the historical context. This, you know, this is from maybe 120, 150 years ago, kind of the beginnings. Over time, you started seeing anthropologists working more in cities, which was probably about 40 years ago, where you started seeing this shift, this gaze going from looking at the exotic other to looking internally and looking at the way that even within the city, we have our own kind of forms of tribes. We have our own affinity groups. We have our own communities of practice. We have our own departments and agencies that each have distinct cultures within organizations. So the same methodology that's been applied to looking at tribes, you know, overseas in some remote locations can also be applied within urban context and suburban context.
It's so very clear to me in my work as an executive search consultant, different companies have different cultures. I mean, Apple is night and day different from Google, from Microsoft, from, they're all quite successful in their specific respective ways, but one can succeed in one culture, but you may not succeed in the other culture because they value and weigh different things.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Can you give me some business examples of anthropology at work? In fact, I'm thinking about changing the AmCham logo. AmCham, bringing anthropology to you.
That would be great.
Can't get enough of it. You're not a pioneer in this. I mean, anthropology has been practiced in business. Can you give me some
Absolutely.
Examples?
Absolutely. Yeah, probably one of the most famous examples is the example of Xerox. So the Xerox company, the printing company, I think this was in the 80s. There was a woman named Lucy Suckman, I believe. She was an anthropologist that they brought on board. She did a, told you about one of the methods, which is behavioral observation. So she set up video cameras and recorded how people were interacting with the Xerox machines. And she saw people were getting frustrated, they weren't getting what they wanted to do. And
that was me, by the way.
Yeah, were you?
Because I actually remember the photocopying machines that go by the way, Xerox.
Yeah, that's right. So, I mean, so that, you know, you saw people just getting really frustrated with the whole experience. And the interesting thing is the engineers, you couldn't fault the engineers. I mean, they designed the thing according to specs. I mean, it was really logical the way that they thought it out. So they're trying to figure out, okay, well, you know, what can we do to make this experience better? So they brought in this anthropologist. She did this study. And then with the outcome of this work, and it was really intensive, very rigorous research around people's interaction with the Xerox machines. And the outcome was the big green button that everyone knows and loves. So they figured out, just give somebody a clear signal, and even the color green, just like a traffic light, signals go ahead, the check mark, you know, so there's a couple other little cues there, okay, or whatever it is. But it's big, it's clear, it's the first thing that people see when they go there. So just want to do a basic copy, a basic print. You know, there might be a few other steps, but that to initiate, you know, ignition,
go.
Yeah, you just hit go, hit the green button.
So that big green button with a green tick mark, I mean, it's ubiquitous now, it's everywhere.
That's right.
That's the result of anthropology at work in the business.
That's
community.
Exactly right, yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh. And there's other, I mean, there's a you know, a wonderful anthropologist named Genevieve Bell, who worked for Intel. She's actually an Australian, but she worked out in California. I think she led a group of 100 social scientists for Intel, sent them around the world to really look at the way that people interact with technology so that Intel can make better design decisions. And, you know, she just recently come back, actually, to Australia, so she's here. So that for any listeners out there who are really interested, there's some good thought leadership in this space and in practical application.
And Genevieve Bell, the Australian, is the one you're referring to.
That's
yes.
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm. As well as myself.
Yes, yeah, yes.
Shameless plug.
Genevieve and DJ Milton, I meant to say, yes. You, in some of the notes I have here, you talk about, you use the phrase co-creation.
Yeah.
What does that mean exactly?
Again, the best and the brightest of an organization coming together and creating a product or service that they intend to meet people's needs. Co-creation is the process of bringing the people who are stakeholders, I guess in the common sense of the word, into that process from the very beginning. In the case of designing something for customers, you might bring the customers into the design process in terms of helping to do the research, analyzing the data that's collected out of the research process, building the prototypes, testing. That's an example of how a customer might be brought into the co-design process. It can also be between two companies where you want to co-design a solution for example, an internal communication strategy. And at PwC, we work with clients often around in this approach. And this is something that they really want because what it does is it allows for them to get that outside expertise, but also leverage their internal capabilities. So there's a skill transfer that happens in the process of, you know, kind of training up and developing the capacity for our clients to learn about design thinking and design techniques, and different methodologies, and lift up their capabilities so that they can then continue this process and do co-creation either internally, co-creating products and services or solutions, as well as externally. Co-creation in general is a really collaborative model of designing products and services that meet people's needs.
That's what I was just about to say. It sounds like intense collaboration, but you're not just fooling around. It's quite a focused endeavor.
Yeah, that's right.
Let me conclude today, GJ, with a couple of questions. One, how do I'm a company, I'm a business, how do I create a 21st century engagement strategy?
Yes, so I think one thing that's really important is to really kind of create and encourage a culture of action learning and co-creation. So action learning is this idea of, you know, an organization kind of doing this internal research process and then coming up with actions off the back of it that are going to be implemented right away. So another example, and I was talking earlier about some of the anthropologists in the field, there's another one named Nick Agafanov, who is really a pioneer in Australia for doing video ethnography.
Video ethnography.
Right. Ethnography, I should mention this earlier, ethnography is the methodology that that kind of put anthropology on the map in terms of its utility and application in the business world. So a lot of people do ethnography now, or some form of it, or draw upon it. They don't necessarily.
And what exactly is ethnography?
So ethnography is just that the methodology is taking those methods. So it's the, you know, the interviews, the surveys, behavioral observation. It's whatever the methods are. I mean, particularly the qualitative research methods that are intended to kind of give that inside-out view of people's lived experience or their day-to-day experience.
So if you're cruising up the Amazon to study the remote tribes, that's ethnography.
That's kind of the domain of anthropologists and ethnographers, yes, and the kind of the remote tribe, kind of, and traditionally. I think that's starting to change a bit where it's been broadened out, but that's right.
Okay, so the qualitative research. Okay, sorry, I interrupted you.
No, I'm sorry. I wanted to kind of mention just Nick because of the work that he does in this space. He's really somebody people should look out for as well. In terms of the action learning and co-creation, I would say that the main thing is just really kind of encourage a culture of curiosity, and that curiosity being kind of focused on what are the needs of our customers, what are the needs of our people and staff, how can we improve the experience, whether it is kind of that more standoff, you know, standalone, like just give us what we need, or if it's more of that kind of personalized interaction. But, you know, really kind of encouraging the generation of those insights within the organization. You know, there's some methodologies out there that are really, really good for that. So one of them is participatory design or co-design, which is what we talked about. And another one is a participatory action research, which is very similar to the co-design. The emphasis on participatory action research is just on the learning. It's really emphasizing the learning outcomes of that exercise, whereas participatory design and co-design are really more about, you know, just developing the design and getting that out. So very similar in terms of the approach, and what it involves is a cyclical iterative process of collecting data, analyzing the data, acting on it or designing for it, and then looking at the impact, reflecting on the impact. Are we achieving our goals? Are we getting where we want to? Yay, nay. If so, then you might continue to kind of iterate on those same lines. Or you might completely pivot because of some of the information that came out of, you know, the data collection and analysis and reflection. But it's getting into this cycle of constantly learning and doing. And I think if you apply that, there's all kind of benefits that come out of really encouraging that behavior. And in terms of engagement, that's the way to really kind of be agile. That, to me, one of the primary ways that you can do that is because you're being responsive to the needs of your customers and your stakeholders in situ at the time and place that's important for them.
Learning and doing. That reminds me of something Ainsley Mears, who is a legendary Australian psychiatrist, wrote years ago that has stayed with me because it's true. Most people simply don't learn from everyday experience. You're suggesting learning and doing. Mm. Okay, one final question for you. Okay, a big company can hire cultural anthropologists, and indeed they should, from what it sounds like. How does a smaller company, how might they take advantage of somebody like you and the skills that you possess?
Oh, first thing I would do is start knocking on the door of a local university where they have an anthropology, or not just anthropology, a social science department. I think that's one of the most under-tapped resources in the academic sector. There's a bunch of people who are, you know, young people who are going through the university. They're interested in these things. They're interested in people. They're interested in understanding what kind of makes people tick. But the number of academic opportunities for them are very narrow. It's something like 3 out of 10 people who go on to do a master's or a PhD in anthropology will actually work in the academic sector. So a lot of other people just kind of totally switch gears because they haven't learned how to communicate the value of what they've learned. But I think that if, you know, the smaller organizations who are interested in this kind of approach to understanding people, absolutely should be knocking on those doors and working out some type of an internship program, something where there's a professor or an instructor who has some kind of quality assurance oversight in terms of if they're working on a project model. And then you have the actual doers, deliverers, doing that work. I mean, all too often, a lot of internships are just, you know, you're running around grabbing coffee, whereas doing something like this is really giving them solid core skills. So, you know, there's a benefit to the students, there's a benefit to the companies. So I really encourage that. And, I came here in 2014 to do my master's in applied anthropology. So I had an opportunity to do exactly that, you know, to go out and work. I worked at a market research firm to get started and start learning the particular applications of anthropology in the business context. You know, there's a lot of benefits that can come out of that approach, I think.
I think our takeaway message is go hire an anthropologist today. You'll be better off for it. You've been listening to the AmCham Business Podcast. Our guest today has been DJ Belton of the Pricewaterhouse Experience Center. He is a cultural anthropologist. And you can listen to all the AmCham podcasts on the website, amcham.com.au. And if you're listening to us through iTunes, you can easily hit the subscribe button, leave a review, make a comment, all of which are very appreciated. In fact, we want to know what you want to know. What are the topics, the people, the issues that are of interest to you? Just email us, podcast@amcham.com.au. You can hear all the podcasts on the website. That's amcham.com.au. This is AmCham, bringing business to you. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to the business podcast of the American Chamber of Commerce in Australia. AmCham has an extensive list of live events throughout Australia. To learn more about our event program and learn how you can access even more opportunities through membership, please visit our website at amcham.com.au. AmCham, bringing business to you.